the manifesto they have is beautiful. We believe the world needs new spaces and homes where like-minded souls can connect and grow and dance barefoot in the sand. I mean, come on. Who doesn't want to do that? But just even the lightness of the writing, even just the sort of innocence, the pure naivety of that, is just so unencumbered with corporate bullshit. And you know, I think people are going to respond to that, particularly these young people who are going to be. I mean, there are more millennials and Gen Zs, the largest cohorts that have ever walked the earth. And you know, if you can connect with potential consumers with that kind of energy and that kind of language, you know, people aren't going to care that they're not getting their Bonvoy points.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Social Hotelier Podcast with me, Sam-Erik Ruttmann. And a warm welcome to the intersection of luxury and limitations. Discover why some of the world's most luxurious accommodations face growth hurdles unlike their counterparts in the luxury goods industry. And what steps do they have to take to stay ahead of the pack? My guest this week is Pierre Schmidt, the founder of Luxury Branding, a luxury consulting firm that conceives and operationalizes mold-breaking strategies for some of the industry's most distinguished brands. Drawing a remarkable career of 30 years advising blue-chip clients, Pierce stands as a revered figure in luxury brand consultancy and hospitality expertise. Luxury Branding developed the Kirshner International corporate brand and masterminded the conceptualization and rollout of one and only resorts. Soon after, George Amarni tasked Pierce to translate his brand into hospitality, and the Brunei Investment Agency engaged Pierce to create a soft brand for its growing portfolio of trophy hotel assets presented under the Dorchester Collection. Currently, he's orchestrating a pivotal transformation of one of my favorite brands, Corinthia Hotels brand, and shaping the future of Saudi Arabia tourism with Red Sea Global. A media commentator and esteemed educator, he shares his insights globally. So welcome, Pierce, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Sam-Erik, it's a pleasure to see you always and to be with you on the podcast today.
Likewise, Pierce. I'm really looking forward to our discussion today. Top luxury brands like Hermes, Dior, and Chanel, Gucci, and rather than say Rolex, I call Vacheron Constantin, are more than just symbols of quality and style. They're global icons. Their lasting appeal across generations speak to their unmatched expertise in branding, marketing, and customer satisfaction. You have mentioned in a recent hotel conference, luxury hotels brands do not fit to the list of 2,500 luxury brands compiled by brand consultancy Interbrand. So what do you see are the issues for luxury hotel brands, and why do hotel brands lack the global recognition and value compared to those luxury goods brands that I mentioned, for instance?
Yes, it's an interesting conundrum. I think possibly you've exaggerated the number of brands on the list, but certainly each year a number of global brand consulting firms publish a list of the most valuable brands, and each of those firms uses a slightly different algorithm and methodology for assessing value. But I think of those studies, perhaps the longest running and most respected is Interbrand's Best Global Brands, and that's sort of headlined with the top 100 global brands that was published in January this year. And I think what's interesting, Sam-Erik, is that actually for the 15th year in a row, there's not one travel, tourism, or hospitality brand in the top 100. And, you know, I think that's a shame. You know, within our own industry, we beat the drum for our brands, whether that's, you know, a long-established organization such as the Ritz-Carlton or Four Seasons. But when you stack them up against some of the brands that you've mentioned, they seem to be minnows compared to those in terms of brand value. So, you know, I've been wondering why that is. You know, is there something so fundamentally different about a brand in hospitality or even in travel and tourism? And think some tourism brands, some destinations pour considerable amounts of money into destination marketing. So when one also considers that we're told that increasingly people are spending on experiences, on time rather than things, you would kind of expect brands that really are fundamentally about time, vacations, travel, staying in a hotel, would show up and do well. So I started to scratch the surface here and sort of try to answer my own question, if you will. You know, why are there no hospitality brands or even travel and tourism brands in that top 100? And, you know, one can start to posit a number of different reasons, and ultimately it's probably a combination of several of them.
Yeah, I mean, if you can look at certain things are like the pricing premium discrepancy as one, and how the brands are dealing with the situation where the market is shifting from the high seasons to the low seasons. Are they really forced by the investors to do something about it in order to keep up the generating cash or and so on? So it would be interesting to know how you see this.
Yeah, there are definitely economic factors. I think let's also be fair. Interbrand's methodology does place quite some weight on assets on the balance sheet. And as you know very well, over the last 15 to 20 years, the hotel industry has shifted away from holding bricks and walls on its balance sheet to an asset-light strategy. So potentially the hospitality brands that we know and love are penalized in that regard. But you raise an interesting question, and it's actually where I started my sort of teardown, if you will, of the luxury hotel brands on pricing premium discrepancy. I did a study that compared the rate for an entry-level classic room in one of London's ultra-luxury hotels and compared the rate that it was able to achieve on that night with a room of exactly the same size, 30 square meters, in an upper upscale hotel. I won't mention the names of the brands. It doesn't matter. One was ultra-luxury, one was upper upscale. The ultra-luxury hotel entry-level room on that evening was selling for £869. The same sized room a mile away in central London in the upper upscale hotel was selling for £572. So that's a premium that ultra luxury was able to command of 52%. And that sounds pretty good. And I think most of us in the luxury hotel industry and revenue management would pat ourselves on the back and say, well done, ultra luxury, go. But if you look at an adjacent category in the luxury goods market, let's say ladies' handbags, you can buy, I can't remember the name of it now, but a Coach little shoulder bag, black shoulder bag, on their store for £450. You can go to the Celine website and buy an almost identical bag. It may be made out of slightly better materials, but let's bear in mind that the materials in the hotel room of the ultra-luxury hotel were better materials than in the upper upscale hotel. The Celine bag is exactly the same dimensions, so we've got a comparable there on dimension, size of room and of handbag. But the Celine handbag sells for £2,150. So that's a premium of 378%. So my argument is that we're not as clever as we think in the luxury hotel business, that yes, we are able to generate a premium over the next chain scale, but the degree of that premium is way less than in other categories. And one can take many, many other examples of that to illustrate the point that I think we're squandering the luxury brand premium that could be ours if we worked harder to earn it.
Yeah, also there must be something about the brand visibility and how the brand is perceived, the advertising and the marketing that some of these brands for luxury bags, luxury goods, leather goods, they have some top fashion models, they have actors, actresses who are, and they are regularly on, not only on in the glossy lifestyle magazines, but also on Instagram. And they are, for instance, Gucci, I remember, changed completely their approach to advertising by going maybe 100% into Instagram. And somehow it must have something to do with how people then see these brands as they're such a desirable, good thing to have. And when you compare it again to our wonderful hotel luxury brands, I mean, what do? They just expect people to book and have a wonderful time.
Yeah, no, you raised two very good points there, Samarik, around visibility. And I think you can look at visibility in two different ways. First, the number of units or doors that the brand has. And again, I did some research, which was, I thought, very revealing. You know, even our largest ultra-luxury hotel brand, which is Four Seasons with 128 open hotels today, just pipping the Ritz-Carlton to the post, who have 127 hotels today. If you compare that number of units, that number of opportunities to stay in a property of the Four Seasons or the Ritz, to the number of stores that, say, Prada or Gucci, who you've just been mentioning, the size contrast is dramatic. So compared to the 128 hotels of Four Seasons, there are no fewer than 638 Prada stores worldwide, 538 Gucci stores worldwide, 460 Louis Vuitton stores. The third largest hotel brand in terms of number of hotels is St. Regis with only 62. So it's actually half the size, less than half the size of both the Ritz-Carlton and Four Seasons. If you compare the size of our hotel chains to automotive dealerships, for example, I was staggered to discover that there are already 400 Tesla retail outlets in the world, and that's a brand that's relatively new. So, you know, nearly 3.5 times the size of the Four Seasons. Even Rolls-Royce, Samarik, you know, arguably the most uber of luxury car marks, and you would think with a very limited distribution. Wait for it, 135 Rolls-Royce dealerships worldwide. So 7 more doors than Four Seasons has hotels. So, you know, clearly, let's be honest, developing, or the complexity of developing a hotel with 200 keys and all of the amenities that we expect in an ultra-luxury hotel, the cost of that development is way greater than opening even a Rolls-Royce dealership. But nevertheless, regardless of the reason for there being fewer doors, the fact that there just are many, many fewer opportunities to walk past an ultra-luxury hotel versus a store of an ultra-luxury fashion brand or the dealership of an ultra-luxury automotive brand, you know, does reduce the visibility. But a point that I'm glad you raised is that actually the way we show up, the way that we create visibility for ourselves in the industry in the kind of marketing channels is also woeful. At the conference you mentioned that I spoke at only last week, I pointed out that in the first 18 pages of the UK edition of Condé Nast Traveler, which, let's face it, should be the house magazine of the luxury travel industry, only two of the brands advertising in those first 18 pages, you know, what we call the front of the book, the key pages, the prime shop window of that magazine. Only two of those adverts were for hotel brands, all the rest of them for fashion and accessory brands. And, you know, I think what this does is highlight something I've noticed in my 30 years of consulting in the luxury hotel industry, that the marketing function in most luxury hotel brands is actually a sales function. Yeah. If you look at the people leading those roles, those functions, the highfalutin chief sales and marketing officer, there's a lot of chief sales, but not a lot of chief marketing. So, you know, I think we have a perishable inventory in hotels. Yes, you can't sell last night's room again tonight, whereas a bag that doesn't sell this season, or, you know, this week, can be still on sale next week. And if it doesn't sell this season, it can go into outlet. At least you can salvage something from the inventory. And, you know, the daily reports that are sent to owners and, you know, VPs on a regional basis, of course, inevitably prioritize demand over brand. We see people trying to hit their RevPAR targets, but there aren't KPIs on whether we're building the brand. And ultimately, as you say, if you don't show up, if you're not in the glossies, if you're not in the right socials, if you're not seen on the shoulder or the arms of the right people, then ultimately you're heading towards being more of a commodity than an aspirational brand. And I think, you know, there are some hotel brands that do good work in the social environment. There are travel brands that do very well. I think, you know, Ryanair, albeit at the completely different end of the market, you know, as a travel brand, has, carves out a really distinctive presence in social media. But I think as a general rule, the Four Seasons, Ritz's and Regis, it's Park Hyatt's, Mandarin's, take a very traditional approach to marketing and brand building. It's driven by, occupancy rather than by creating brand equity. And I think we need to be very careful because there are brands with greater brand equity in the luxury market that are moving into our business. And we've seen that with people like Armani, Baccarat, with Missoni. Okay, that didn't work. Versace. So I think at the end of the day, brand will win, and brands of the strong can learn the hospitality business. They can partner with hospitality operators as Bulgari has done with Ritz-Carlton, whereas it's going to be much harder unless we wake up for luxury hotel brands to create genuine brand strength.
Yeah, it's interesting. What factors determine the distinction between, you mentioned ultra-luxury hotel brands and then luxury. What are the factors that determine the distinction between these two, between the luxury and ultra-luxury hotel brands? How does it, for the viewers who are, and the audience, they might not be very clear that is there a distinction, or is it because of a ultra-luxury brand is just smaller in terms of footprint, or how do you see this?
Yeah, there is actually no definition. And I think, maybe as an industry, we should call upon STR and Hotstats, who are the kind of data experts in this field, to actually create a segmentation to come up with a rationale for it. Of course, STR's chain scales are based on RevPAR across different regions. So, the easiest way to look at it, Sam Eric, is rate. So those luxury hotel brands that achieved the highest ADR by occupancy and therefore RevPAR are the ultra luxury ones. So, STR today looks at data for, I think, 127 luxury hotel chains. If you go down that list, you can apply a qualitative measure and say, well, I've been to that brand's hotels, I've looked at them, I've seen the service they provide, I look at the design and the amenities, I look at the quality of the FF&E and the OS&E, and I can just tell that whilst it may technically qualify as luxury according to STR's sort of, data-driven approach, it hasn't got that extra je ne sais quoi. So I think most of us who have knocked around this industry for a while know the hotel brands, where you go in and you do get that feeling. I actually recently produced a list of 27. I've previously had a list of 36 that's been reported online, but I took another look at it. So yeah, of the 127, I guess I'm saying 27 of those are the creme de la creme, the cream of the crop. And I think most commentators, most experts, most purveyors of luxury would recognize those brands as having something that makes them a cut above the rest. And that is reflected in their performance on a sort of RevPAR basis. But I think it's also reflected in their performance in terms of the desirability they have towards owners. So ownership, looking at bringing in a flag to help establish an asset in a city, or has a prime location in a resort destination, will look to match their asset to a brand, and certain brands have a cachet and are reckoned by the consultants of this world, the JLLs and the Deloittes of this world, to help that owner produce a return on investment that, I guess at the end of the day relies on rate and an ability to fill at that rate. So I think there are a number of ways of looking it at, but ultimately to say that one is ultra luxury or another is not is a somewhat subjective judgment. I mean, anecdotally, the famous example of the fact that there are no rules comes from Dubai, where, do you remember the Burj Al Arab sort of let it be known, I think, with a journalist fairly early on in its life, that it was the world's only 7-star hotel. And of course, there is no 7-star rating. There's no 6-star. In fact, even what is a 5-star rating varies from country to country, from tourism organization to grading organization. So it's a very un sort of calibrated world out there. there are organizations like Forbes Travel Guide that you know try to issue stars using different, you know, more formal criteria, but it's a little bit like the Wild West. So a long answer to a simple question, but we kind of know who they are.
Yeah. I mean, somehow about the ultra luxury brands, I see them as that they tend to limit the growth despite the market demand, because they want to have this little bit of an elitist and cater to that 1% of the creative crowd, and also that they are they say they can charge what they want as long as they give to this 1% what they want. Am I off about a bit, or do you think there is some logic to what I said?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that the ultra luxury brands are small in terms of number of units because they wish to maintain exclusivity. I think they would love us to believe that was the case. Look, we've talked about it a little bit already. The cost today of developing, of acquiring a site and developing, you know, conceiving of design and architecture and then, you know, going through the construction phase and developing all of the fittings and furnishings and staffing for an ultra luxury hotel is huge. You know, you can easily spend 2 million, you name your currency, pounds, dollars, euros per key. And then that adds up to a very significant capital outlay. So the first point is that there's just a limit to the number of opportunities and developers worldwide seeking to put that kind of capital into that kind of real estate. So I think it's actually the real estate side of the hotel industry that's probably limiting the growth, rather than the luxury brands saying we only want to have 128 doors. I think if they could grow faster, they would, because at the end of the day, most of these companies, Four Seasons would be an exception, but most of them are part of public companies that sort of have a 15% compound annual growth imperative. So if they could grow faster, I'm sure they would. Interestingly, if you look at those 27 luxury hotel brands that I was talking about earlier, I just did a little bit of maths before we spoke. Between them, this is really interesting, between them, they are operating 795 hotels. But bear in mind that 127 of those are Ritz and 128 of those are Four Seasons. But you know, even accepting those two outliers, those two sort of huge outliers, remember, both of those are twice the size of the third largest operator, which is St. Regis, was 62. But right across the 27, the average number of hotels that each of those ultra-luxury hotel brands has open today is 29. So it's a very, very small number. And if we excluded Ritz and Four Seasons from that number, it would fall dramatically, you know, to probably an average of, I don't know, 15 or something. So you're absolutely right. The brands are very small in terms of number of units. In a world where we're getting increasing demand, you talk about the 1%. I mean, that's growing, you know, and it's always 1%, but the amount of wealth that it's capturing is growing. The world is becoming wealthier. Younger people are becoming wealthier sooner. And, you know, if we look at not just the 1%, but the 0.1%, the amount of wealth in that bracket, I mean, essentially the poverty gap is widening. And there's a concentration of wealth towards the 0.1, the 1%, the 2%. So I think there's plenty of demand. And, you know, what's happened with rates in the last 2-3 years since, you know, the end of COVID in destinations like Dubai, you know, demonstrate that almost hotel brands can price with impunity. There doesn't seem to be any great sensitivity to price, and there's a huge amount of development in key gateway cities like London and New York and Miami and Dubai. So yes, when you get a, you know, kind of black swan event like COVID, then, you know, the hospitality industry is a horrible place to be. But, you know, when things are relatively normal at the moment, despite everything we hear about, you know, cost of living crisis at the other end of the market, you know, people are doing extremely well. And so I think the growth is more to do with the limitations of the real estate side and making these projects pay, which is why, of course, we see a huge growth in the kind of branded residences programs, because that's a way for developers to, you know, get some capital receipts back in during and after the completion of the project, and to sort of make the cost of the hotel that they're left with a little more realistic.
Yeah. How do you see the... Oh, how does the mindset of revenue generation differ between ultra-luxury and an upscale hospitality segment? How do you see how the... Is there a differentiation there or how?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's enough of a differentiation. I think one of the things I was talking about in the conference last week is the sort of homogenization of our brands. We say we have brands in the hotel industry, but if you scratch beneath the surface, I mean, let's look at St. Regis and Ritz-Carlton, both now owned by Marriott. What really is the difference between these two labels? I mean, you know, if you work for St. Regis, I'm sure you're right in and say, oh, it's this, 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 and this. But, you know, I can think maybe it's butlers at St. Regis and maybe it isn't at Ritz. But I think to the outside world, there's precious little that really distinguishes these brands. And that's between brands, you know, in the same ultra-luxury segment. If you then look at, you know, brands between the different tiers, between ultra-luxury and luxury, between luxury and upper-upscale, between upper-upscale and upscale, unfortunately, I think that behind those doors, behind those kind of branded windows, is a fairly generic machine churning out fairly standardized hospitality, because that's where efficiency comes from. So yeah. It kind of suits these behemoths, the Accors and the IHGs and the Hiltons, Hyatts of the world, to have as much standardization. Of course, they'll protest that they don't. They've got brand teams. They, you know, we're not cookie cutter. But the reality of it is that actually the way we develop hotels, the way we run hotels, the programming that we develop, and then right through into your sales marketing strategies, your revenue management, it is driven off the same systems, is shoehorned into the same loyalty programs. We'll talk about that in a minute, I'm sure. And I think, you know, in terms of revenue management, what an ultra-luxury customer is prepared to pay for different elements of their stay is not something that the ultra-luxury hotel brands are really thinking about hard enough. You know, there are conventional ways of earning revenue from a guest night stay, and we tend to apply quite sort of blunt techniques to, you know, extracting that money from our guest, whereas I think there are actually much more sophisticated ways that could be done, and that actually other luxury brands and other sectors do.
Yeah, I have read, and I talked to some of my friends about the young travelers who are who are the wealthy travelers. They're also looking at not only them, but there's a sustainable hospitality aspect. The aspect of sustainability are in these hotels, and also the recent glamping developments. For instance, Aman is coming on board with some of the glamping sites, and there are like 5,000 US per night experiences. That is, in my mind, quite an ultra-luxury experience if you are in the desert somewhere and you have this quite a nice setup, which we call it glamping only.
Oh, for sure. And you only need to look to Africa, to the high-end safari lodges, to see this working. You know, it's not new. You know, brands like Conservation Corporation and Beyond, as it is today, Wilderness Safaris, Singita, have been charging some of the highest rates of any hotels anywhere in the world. You know, yeah. 20 years ago, Singita was charging $1,000 per person per night. Of course, you're buying a two-day, maybe two nights, maybe 3 day, you know, very intense experience. You're paying to see, you know, wonderful nature and animals, you know, not just a room. But I think that goes to prove what people will pay for. Yeah. If you create an incredible, you know, mind-altering, life-changing experience, then people will pay you anything for that. If you're selling 31 square meters or even 200 square meters of suite, and, you know, you'll bring the food to the room quickly after you order it, and you'll give the guy a hand with his bag when he's leaving, then you're going to be commoditized and get really what the value of that space and that service is. So, you know, sustainability new experiences. Experiences is a one-upmanship game. You know, my friend Joe Pine, who co-authored, you know, the Experience Economy book, you know, calls it the been there, done that phenomenon. So however good an experience is, when you have been there and done that, you need another hit. You need the hit to be higher. It's almost a drug. You know, the first hit is great, but then you need double the quantity to get the same effect the next time. And I think what you're seeing with the younger generations to whom you refer is that they've grown up in the experience economy. They have been spoiled, frankly, with exceptional experiences. They've been able to jump on very low-cost, no-frills airlines and go much further than probably you or I did when we were 18 or 19. In fact, my son is 19, has just come back from an incredible 6 months in South Africa, in Kenya, and in Mauritius. You know, my year off before I went up to uni was spent teaching in a school in Berkshire in England. So, you know, he is much more experienced at the age of 19 than I was probably until I was about 30. So they're bringing that appetite and that hunger for experiences to the market as they become wealthier. As I said earlier, we're seeing the younger millennials and even the older Gen Z having wealth and income that their previous generations just never saw. Partly because they're making it on the internet, they're making it through Bitcoin trading. You know, they're going on YouTube and being taught how to make money. Okay, I'm talking about my son here a little bit, but what's happening is they're having those great experiences younger, and therefore, you know, in their mid to 20s to late 20s, they want the next level of experience. And so I think those of us who are experienced creators and stagers have to be constantly innovating and evolving to bring them something that's going to make them go, oh, wow, that's new, that was amazing, that's worth me putting on my Instagram story and showing off.
Yeah. I had, as my guest some time ago, Ruben Woodhead, who has, with her husband, White Desert Antarctica. And that is it's an amazing experience what they are creating, and they are doing very, very well. People are willing to pay close to 100,000 US for that 1 week experience, and obviously the logistics and the costs involved and the safety involved and all the meals and everything that has to be put together for the one time experience for many travelers, that they will make it to that maybe the last paradise of this earth, is they're willing to pay that, and she mentioned to me that they are doing very, very well, and people are willing to spend that money just to experience that, have that experience once in a lifetime. So
it shows the market's there. Yeah, for sure. You know, if you create something excellent in the experiential domain, people will pay almost anything for it. And, you know, there are companies like Black Tomato, the Lumiere, you know, these small expeditions that you're talking about, you know, even these crazy guys that went down, you know, in that submersible submarine, you know, they're looking for that ultimate thing. Unfortunately, they paid the ultimate price for that one.
Well, let's move over back to the mainstream again about how loyalty programs are being used by hotel groups, and particularly larger hotel groups that has the sort of the luxury brand aspect. Some of them have been taking advantage of that. They have this ultra luxury brand in their portfolio, and then these are being used to burn points. And what is your view on that's being used as a tool to entice people to use their hotel group and their loyalty programs?
No, you're absolutely right, and I'm glad that I'm not the only one that sees this game going on. Look, points create a huge, what's known as a contingent liability on the balance sheet of airlines or, you know, car rental companies or hotels. So, you know, the accountants running those companies, you know, want those points to be spent, to be burned, so that liability goes down. And obviously, you know, we're being simplistic here. If we can say that a night in an ultra luxury brand within the group burns off, you know, seven times the number of points that a night in a mid-scale hotel, possibly where that point was earned. This is the interesting thing. You know, the road warriors who are doing 200 nights a year on the road are often staying in, you know, let's say more mid-market properties, but they're earning their points through volume of stays rather than the value of the stay. But when it comes to, oh, you know, darling, I've got all these points, you know, should we go to South Beach for the weekend? You know, they trade up to an ultra luxury hotel. It's a win for almost everybody apart from the brand, because, you know, obviously the owner gets a reduced, you know, ADR on that booking, but he or she gets occupancy, but possibly at times when it's difficult. The hotel brand or the loyalty program, you know, manages to burn off a whole load of points. The traveler is cock-a-hoop because they get to stay in a fancy pants hotel and not the one they spend their life in during the week. But I had a personal experience of this recently in a hotel, actually in Miami South Beach, where I checked in with my wife and son, and we couldn't believe the people that were in the lobby, that were around the pool. You know, this is one of the more famous ultra-luxury hotel brand names. And yet the people in the hotel were not, without being snobby about it, but they were not the people that were what we would imagine would be in that hotel. And, you know, we'd paid, you know, premium rate to be there. It's a bit like, if you've paid $6,000 to fly from London to New York in British Airways first class, and then someone is upgraded from economy, you know, as the doors of the flight shut, you know, you feel a bit sick about the fact that you've paid the rack rate for the flight and someone's getting it for free. But I now imagine this multiplied by, you know, hundreds of people in a hotel. You've paid for an ultra luxury hotel room, and yet the people that are in there. So This damages the brand, you know, because brands are about, you talked about it earlier, they're about who the company you keep, they're about the people that you're seen with. And, you know, fashion brands have had some difficulties with this over the last 10, 15 years as different, you know, music industry segments have adopted luxury brands and, you know, have been challenged by the kinds of people that are seen to wear them or taking a brand to the street when it didn't belong in the street. But what they've done very well is figure out how to lean into those, how to work with it rather than against it. And I'm not sure the hotel industry has figured that out. So I think, yeah, the loyalty programs are not loyalty programs. They don't create loyalty. It's a misnomer.
Yeah.
They're actually addiction programs. They're there for people that don't want to not collect those points. You know, it becomes a habit, and like any habit, it's addictive. It isn't building loyalty at a fundamental level, and I personally would like to see the ultra luxury brands not be part of it. I think those ultra luxury brands, were they independent, and frankly, until they're sold, and while they are still independent, Four Seasons doesn't have a loyalty program. You know, it builds loyalty in a different way, but not a points-based loyalty program. If it was ever bought by Marriott or Hilton, God forbid, you know, it no doubt would be plugged into into one straight away. But I think they're much better off without that form of loyalty, because then it makes them rely on actually building true affinity with its guests through treating them. And although I think we don't do that as well as we could. Again, one of the points I was making last week, you know, we work so hard whilst our guest is on property, whether it's two nights in a city or for maybe 7 or 10 in a resort application. But we then let them go. You know, we sort of, it's like a holiday fling in a resort or a sort of two night stand in a city, but we don't stay in touch, you know, well enough. So I think CRM and how do we bring our guests, how do we continue our relationship with them, not through a points-based mechanism, but how do we sustain a relationship that really is a relationship? How do we show up in their city? How do we remind them of the time that they had with us on holiday? I think there's a lot more we could be doing there to really create a much deeper and more enduring brand of affinity.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I have some personal experience of brands like Cartier in Dubai and maybe it was Cartier in Paris, how they kept sending handwritten notes to us. I mean, we're not obviously big shoppers there, but we bought once in a lifetime some item there. But we were receiving handwritten notes in a nicely handwritten with an ink pen, a proper, you know, and a very nice paper, and they kept just saying hello and wish to come and visit us. And then once you arrive back at the shop, they are making you feel very, very welcome. And it's not like you're being pushed to buy something, but it's just that relationship building, which is an art, which I feel that some hotel brands are taking for granted, and they're not doing enough to embrace that the relationship and the memories that there was developed during their stay. They should really go much further there.
Yeah, I recently was flying to Saudi and realized I hadn't forgotten to pack a tie. So in the Terminal 3 at Heathrow, I went to the Salvatore Ferragamo shop and spent about 30 minutes picking out a tie. And I was surprised, you know, that when I got back to my home in London a week later, there was a beautiful letter written to me on real paper by the sales guy that was for a tie that cost, I don't know, £120 yeah. or something. You know, you couldn't get a room in a Premier Inn for £120, but I would never get a letter from the general manager of the ultra luxury hotel, you know, a week after I stayed, even though I might have spent, you know, £800 or £900. So yeah, I think we're very good on property, but I just don't think we've understood that we've built a relationship. I mean, I always say we get to sleep with our customer in hotel business. Come on, it doesn't get more intimate than that. You know, the poor guy in Ferragamo didn't get to sleep with me. You know, I went into his store, I took a tie and I left, and still he bothered to write. Yeah. But the hotel where I have this, you know, I eat with you, I take my clothes off in front of you in the spa, I, you know, get into bed, I shower, and, you know, it's a very intimate relationship. Yeah. But once you say goodbye to me and take my credit card and pay, I kind of don't matter. Yeah. So I think there's a churn that we need to, you know, dismiss and get into that much more sustained relationship yeah. building business.
I'm actually excited now about the work you're doing now in Saudi Arabia. And I mean, I keep reading with envy of what is going on there. And so could you speak about that exciting development and what makes the development so different from others? I mean, I read things, but you are sort of very close to it with the Red Sea global development and so on. What are they doing that makes this so unique and so different to anything else that we may have seen?
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. It is different to anything that I think anybody has seen. So yes, I've been very privileged for the last 3 years now to be a member of the advisory board of Red Sea Global. Red Sea Global is a Saudi development organization. You know, it's a key role player in the Saudi Vision 2030, which, as you know, is the sort of personal vision of the Crown Prince, a very enlightened strategy to move the nation forward, to give the hugely young population that characterizes the Saudi nation great things to do. And of course, you know, to migrate the economy from a sort of carbon-based one to diversified. And travel and tourism, you know, represents a major pillar of that diversification effort. So we have a number of projects that are being driven under Red Sea Global, the two most notable of which are giga projects, as they're known. So these are huge undertakings. So the first giga project is in fact called Red Sea, the destination Red Sea. And then slightly further north on the Red Sea coast is Amala. So across those two destinations, Red Sea Global is currently developing 75 hotels. And all of those hotels will be positioned at upper upscale and then luxury and ultra luxury, with a heavy emphasis. It's a sort of inverse pyramid, so more ultra luxury, then some luxury and a little bit of upper upscale. 8,000 keys in the Red Sea destination and then 3,000 in Amala. You know, these are vast sites. I think in combination, there's 32,000 square kilometers of land. But we're only developing, you know, maybe 5% of that land area at the Red Sea. So that's 5% of 28,000 square kilometers. And then perhaps 1% of the 4,000 square kilometers in Amala. So it's very, very low density development. And of course, there's nothing there at the moment. This is literally a green field well, actually, there's not much green, but there's blue in this incredible, pristine Red Sea itself. You've got the desert, of course. You've got beautiful coastline. You've got an archipelago of incredible islands, 90 islands in the Red Sea destination. And we've also got mountains. So I always say to people, there's kind of four territory expressions of these projects. You've got mountain, desert, coast, and then island. So because it's greenfield, there are no legacy issues. There's no legacy infrastructure. There's nothing that you wouldn't have done that you wish you hadn't have done in the past to prevent you from doing the right thing. So in a way, you've got a blank sheet. The second great advantage is that, you know, obviously with the wealth that the current carbon economy produces and the need to reinvest that, there's not unlimited money, but there's a good budget to do things properly. Often cutting corners financially is what sacrifices quality. So you've got this greenfield opportunity, you've got the wherewithal to do the right thing, and then I think you've got vision. You know, you've got the vision of a leader that wants to create the best of the best. So you put all of these things into the mix and you've got a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So, you know, John Pagano, who's our group CEO at Red Sea Global, very early on, I think actually created a new development agenda, a new modus operandi, which we now term regenerative tourism. So the ambition by 2040 is that every hotel, every aspect of these two key destinations should have a net carbon benefit to the planet. And there are many, many different fronts on which that benefit is being earned. You know, there's amazing work going on in terms of sustainable development, in terms of not damaging, but actually enhancing, leaving the environment where we're building actually improved. So whether that's, you know, the preservation of turtles' nests or coral regeneration programs, of course, the destinations will be powered entirely through sustainable energy, renewables. There's amazing work going on in terms of how the vehicle fleets are fueled. You know, even seaplanes eventually, I'm sure, will be electric, or if not electric, hydrogen powered. So I think what this is doing is attracting talent from around the world, the world's best architects, the world's best interior designers, the world's best engineers, the best marine biologists, just anyone who's got something to give. And, you know, you come from that world, I come from the world, because we're drawn to the opportunity to do something great. And then when you get an organization like Red Sea Global and John's leadership that's able to marshal those resources and deploy them in the way that they have, you're going to have a spectacular result. So, you know, it's really satisfying that we have our first two resorts open already. The Six Senses Southern Dunes opened in the fourth quarter of last year, closely followed by the St. Regis, Red Sea, and the Ritz-Carlton Reserve will be opening very shortly. So that's the first three hotels out of phase one, which is 16 hotels in Red Sea. But now the pace of opening is accelerating, and I think, you know, within the next year or two, you're going to see, you know, something in the region of 20 to 30 spectacular properties in the Red Sea and Amala, and then the world will come.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it already. You know, I think people will come to something as spectacular as these places are, the beauty, the care with which they've been developed, and then, you know, they will be curious. The world's travel media will come. They are already coming. Nicola Chilton wrote a great piece in Condé Nast Traveler recently about her stay at the St. Regis. They will scratch, they will poke, they will peer behind the curtains, they will ask the difficult questions. And I think, you know, yes, Saudi Arabia has a reputation in the world, but what better means than tourism to throw a light on what's going on and to enable people to come and see for themselves. I think we're all too quick in this world to throw stones when we live in glass houses. And, you know, the very fact that the Saudi nation is putting this kind of investment into this kind of development is an open invitation to the world to come and see. And I'm sure when they do, what they will find will will blow their minds. And I don't just mean in terms of product either. What struck me on my visits to the kingdom is the people. You know, Saudis, I'm sure you know, you've met them, are incredibly hospitable innately. And now they're getting the opportunity to serve, to work in these phenomenal assets that have been created. Before that opportunity, they've been given amazing training. Some people are going overseas to some of the top hotel schools. They're getting exposure in top hotels. Red Sea Global itself is investing in amazing educational facilities and resources. So this economy, make no mistake, is going to be a vast, you know, direct and indirect employer of Saudi talent. You know, we have quite stringent targets for Saudiization, the number of Saudis in key roles. And I think it's giving young people immense pride in the nation to see their country opening up, to become aware as they do. I often bump into them in travel trade fairs like, you know, ITB or WTM or IRTM. And there they are, young Saudis, you know, acting as ambassadors and representatives for this incredible piece of product development. They can be so proud that it's their nation giving birth to, you know, some of the most spectacular, you know, whether that's in Alula or up in Neom or in the Red Sea or Al Mala, it doesn't matter. This is a sort of joined up ecosystem. And, you know, I think it's honestly going to change the orientation of the tourism map. You know, I've had clients for many years in famous resort destinations like, you know, the Maldives or Mauritius or Seychelles, to name a few. And I think, you know, if I was leading the tourism organizations in those places and places like them, I would be scratching my head very vigorously thinking, how are we going to compete? Because, you know, our product's going to look very tired. And to your earlier point about what the younger generations are looking for in their travel, the resorts and hotels in those places haven't been developed with those sustainability goals in mind. And, you know, it goes even beyond people who are working, you know, the outreach that Red Sea Global is doing in terms of enabling the communities and supporting the culture in the neighboring towns is phenomenal, and guests will be able to go and enjoy the fruits of that work. So look, it's early days. We've been in a development phase for the last 5 years. Now the first product is coming to market. Not everything is ready. Not everything will be perfect, but you know, this is a vision that extends, you know, until at least 2040. And I think by then, you know, Saudi is going to be a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. It's very exciting. I mean, I was last year in Berlin at the International Hotel Investment Forum, and I went to the Kingdom Pavilion, if they call it, and I met a couple of very professional ladies who were representing some of the developments, and very well spoken. And I mean, obviously, I should not expect anything less, but they were very well prepared in briefing about the destination, and so I really enjoy the. They were not acting like sales reps, but they actually were ambassadors of the destination. So what you were saying earlier is that there's that sense of pride about their country and also and the future. So it's very nice to see that and how that vision actually translates into action when you meet them in trade shows.
Yeah, it really does. And, you know, I sometimes wonder how they got to that point. But of course, you know, they've been educated all over the world. And yeah. I think what you're seeing is a migration back home now. You know, maybe these were people who would have otherwise have stayed away, but the Crown Prince has figured out, you know, he's kind of not a lot older than many of them, that, you know, unless there's something at home to retain people, then they will go away. So, you know, I think it was enlightened to start this program, and, you know, people are coming back and wanting to be part of this journey that the nation is going through.
Yeah. Well, that was Saudi Arabia. Now, just finally, you have made a list of some niche brands, and you gave me the list of 21, and I was just amazed of what new players in the industry are doing. And could you share a little bit about the findings about the future of these brands, and what do they have to do to serve better than the legacy brands. I mean, you gave some very good examples, but I'd love you to just share your views on this.
Yes, we touched on it earlier. I think focus and, you know, what one might somewhat clumsily call nichification, you know, finding a niche and serving that niche with utter conviction is going to be the recipe for future success. You know, I think we're all aware of this, the life cycle in this industry of how a brand starts, it scales, it reaches a number of properties, and then it's sold. Because it does take time, and the founders and the entrepreneurs that have that drive, you know, get tired. You know, they reach a point in their lives where it's right to exit and to, you know, release some capital for their efforts. And then inevitably, you know, they've been backed by private equity, and that has a certain timeline and horizon for when it needs to crystallize again. So there's a sort of maybe a 15, 20 year brand development cycle, and then there's probably a shorter cycle of an investment cycle where private equity firms come in and come out, and then eventually need to exit to a trade buyer. And you know, again, without naming names, we're all aware of brands that have somehow peaked, been sold, and then, you know, frankly, the founders or the people driving that brand, you know, check out. You know, they've been financially compensated, maybe they've grown tired of it, and seemingly the corporates that take over don't have the same love. I mean, how could they? That's, you know, their job is now to get a return on what was outlaid. So they start looking at different ways of accomplishing that. So I think you start to see a deterioration, or if not a deterioration in absolute terms, a change in the kind of the nature and the quality of the brand. And what that does is give an opportunity for others to step into their shoes and to create something that the customer who was a champion of that brand is now not finding there anymore. So what I think is fascinating is how we're seeing brands. Do you remember those restaurants that kind of did one thing? So you kind of had, you know, the burger and the lobster, or the, you know, it's the one dish restaurant. Yes. And I'm almost seeing a similar thing sort of with the one theme hotel brand. And, you know, a couple that I love, there's one called the Living Circle, that have really doubled down on food. I'm a big foodie, so I'm going to pick some food ones for you. And their strapline is luxury fed by nature. And, you know, it's so niche, you know, run by dedicated hosts, rice, vegetables, fruit, and a whole array of exquisite products, including wine, of course, is whisked from our farms directly to your table. That's how we define luxury. I love it. Yeah. You know, it's very narrow. And I admire that. I mean, who knows whether it will succeed? Is it too narrow? I don't know. We're not making that judgment call today. But I love the fact they've focused on such a narrow thing and are going to build their world on that. Here's another one I like, Appellation. I think this is another breakaway from Four Seasons. Four Seasons is the place to break away from and create a brand. Obviously, you know, Neil Jacobs came from there to Six Senses. You've got the guys at Auberge, ex-Four Seasons. And I think these guys were senior in the food and beverage department of Four Seasons. And they've created a brand that's really all about food and wine. And that's music to my ears. I like Zanier. You know, there are a number of these. There's Bermier and Zanier. They've maybe got to 5, 6, 7 hotels, really driven by passion, driven by the obsession of often a well-traveled individual, an aesthete, a cultured person that wants hospitality that they want, and they know there's a market out there, and they know that today that market out there can find them if they do it right on social. I think the old days where you had to have that conventional distribution network, otherwise you were going to be invisible, has gone. You can reach over that. You can get directly to your community, to your audience, if you know how to do it. That kind of language. You know, people aren't going to care that they're not getting their Bonvoy points. I mean, it's not a new one, but I love Habitas. If you read the manifesto they have, it's beautiful. We believe the world needs new spaces and homes where like-minded souls can connect and grow and dance barefoot in the sand. I mean, come on. Who doesn't want to do that? But just even the lightness of the writing, even just the sort of innocence, the pure naivety exactly. of that, is just so unencumbered with corporate bullshit. And, you know, I think people are going to respond to that, particularly these young people who are going to be. I mean, there are more millennials and Gen Zs, the largest cohorts that have ever walked the earth. And, you know, if you can connect with potential consumers with that kind of energy and that kind of language, you know, people aren't going to care that they're not getting their Bonvoy points. In fact, they'll be happy not to.
Yeah, terrific examples. You picked up some fantastic, and we could go on and on to have an episode about discussing about these different brands. But I think more importantly, I think that everyone should make an effort to try something new and try some of these new brands that are coming up. They're not necessarily ultra luxury from that, but they have a idea which is, and they have a passion which is unlike what you see in many places these days. So it's very nice. Thank you very much for sharing that list.
Yeah, that's right. Idea and then passion of execution. That's actually all you need. But but somehow the business of business often gets in the way of those two things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we have had a very good discussion here. And maybe my last question is that if people are interested to find out more about luxury branding, how can they do so? Where can they find you? I know I find you always in the Skift and Forbes and Financial Times, where you are commenting on things. But for everyone else, where can they find you?
Yeah, well, we are to be found at luxury-branding.com is our website. And you can email me if anything I've said has intrigued or annoyed you at piers.s@luxury-branding.com or LinkedIn, of course, where you can find me as Piers Schmidt.
Very good, Piers. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this discussion. It was, as usual, I learn so much from you every time we have a discussion. So, and this was another special occasion to do that. So thank you very much.
Well, likewise, it's been an absolute pleasure. And we'll speak again soon.
Thanks for joining us for this luxurious roller coaster ride through the world of hospitality branding. Piers Schmidt gave us the lowdown on why luxury hotels sometimes feel like the middle child compared to their flashy luxury goods siblings. From pricing quirks to the wild world of experiential luxury, we had a blast dissecting it all. Stay tuned for more laughs and insights on our next episode. And on your way out, press the thumbs up button. A short review would mean the world to me. Until next time.